The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Communities. People everywhere are talking about how do we build community, and I'm with a person that has been looking at that for quite a while.
Creating a Life Together, Practical Tools to Grow Eco-Villages and Intentional Communities. It's an attempt on my part to find out, when communities are successful, what did they do that made them successful?
I traveled all over, meeting outcasts, billionaires, the foreclosed and the forgotten. I wanted to find out why such a disparate group were all heading for the hills at the same time.
We arranged for people to come onto this land, and then since then we've just been trying to build up a community that's working towards self-sufficiency. There are a couple of people that work, but I would say the majority of people and the people that originally came to the site and founded it are living without money.
It's been a long couple of weeks for the people bedding down in this community center in Puerto Real, one of the many towns in southern Spain hit hard by the ongoing economic crisis. They are mostly landless peasants, day laborers without land and full-time jobs. 60-year-old Juan Manuel Sanchez Gordillo has become the face of anti-capitalist resistance in Spain.
Not many people outside Spain know the name of the village, but they may have heard of the Spanish villagers who invaded supermarkets and took away food for their neighbours, saying that they were starving because of the recession. This is Marinaleda in southern Spain, which turned itself into a cooperative in 1991 and has been one of the few parts of the country to have withstood the recession. The journalist Dan Hancock's heard the stories and has spent the last few years researching and writing his book about what he calls the village against the world. Dan, first give us a bit of potted history. What is the actual constitution of this village and how on earth did they achieve it?
They began in 1975, I suppose, the year that Franco died. It's a village of 2,500 people, to give it some context. It's a large village or a small town, if you like, in the middle of nowhere in southern Spain, in Andalusia, like a sort of an hour or so from Sevilla, not near any sort of large conurbation. And they'd been poor for centuries. The current utopian community they've created is all dates to the late 1970s. They spent most of the 1980s protesting, going on hunger strike, occupying, blockading. The key moment really was 1991 when they won the land from a nearby
1,200 hectares of land,
that's
a huge
right.
amount of land.
Yes, it's enough to employ the entire village. I mean, and the contrast of the extreme poverty and unemployment of the late 70s, and indeed the decades before that under Franco's dictatorship and the centuries before that, is contrasted with the fact that today they can claim they have only a handful of unemployed people, most of them recent arrivals from other villages.
You talk about it as a village, but you use the word pueblo, and that has a very specific political meaning as well as a cultural meaning, doesn't it?
That's right. It's a fantastic word, pueblo. It means the village, it means the conurbation, but it also means the people. And that's critical because there is a sense of identity there, a sense of community solidarity, and a sense of, like, you know, cultural personality that is identified with the pueblo. That means that even if you were to stray many, many miles from the place you were born, you are still regarded as a son or daughter of the pueblo. In this particular village's case, that personality means a great sense of humour, but also a strident and radical sense of left-wing politics.
So how have they withstood the recession?
They own the land collectively. They have enough land to farm and provide work for everybody in the village. If you contrast this with the big cities, I mean, basically Spain's economic miracle was founded on the same kind of mythical sense of boundless expansion. And the construction industry in the south of Spain was something that seemed to offer relentless kind of growth. And that meant that when the crash came, it came particularly hard. You had people commonly like leaving school at the age of 14 or 15 with no qualifications to go and work on building sites because they were being offered remarkable amounts of money to do so. And the entire sort of Spanish landscape is now scarred with these kind of half-built apartment blocks and bankrupt companies that ran them.
You describe the village as in two bits, which are gradually being joined up. And there's a peculiar, unique economy to their house building, isn't there?
That's right. Like a lot of Spanish pueblos, you have an uptown and a downtown. And yeah, they've managed to hit upon this fantastic system whereby they secure basic building materials and indeed architectural help from the regional government in Seville. But then they build the houses themselves. They're called autoviviendas. And everybody mucks in to help. You get your friends and your neighbours to help. You take time off from working on the farm, on the village cooperative for a few months. And then at the end, the house is effectively yours. You pay 15 euros a month as a kind of quote-unquote mortgage. And that's it.
So if I go along as a rich London tourist and want to buy somewhere there, can I buy one of these houses?
You can't buy one of those. There is a waiting list to create these autoviviendas. You can actually buy... I'm being followed on Twitter by someone called Marinaleda House for Sale. So there is private enterprise within the village, and that includes the ability to buy houses. But the model they're working on with these autoviviendas is to create houses where no one can speculate and accumulate profit. The alternative is what led to Spain's current crisis, in fact.
How much of the success of Marinaleda is due to the charisma of the mayor? It's very much a one-man thing, isn't it? And he's known internationally as the Robin Hood mayor or the Don Quixote mayor.
Or the Spanish William Wallace was the other one that I've seen. Yes, I mean, he is integral to the story and has been from the outset. He led that initial upsurge of revolutionary energy in the late 1970s that led the beginning of this, what they call La Lucha, the struggle. And he remains the elected mayor to this day. I mean, they're still subject to Spanish election law, it bears repeating. It's a sort of quasi-autonomous village, but they still have to have regional elections, and he cleans up every single time. Now, there's a kind of paradox at the heart of the village because it's all about people power, and it's sort of against a Soviet-style model. He detests Stalin. He doesn't sort of want great statues of himself in every sort of household and on every street. And yet, he is integral to leading the way. He's always holding the microphone, or rather, the megaphone, and standing at the front of every protest. His face is plastered on all of the election posters.
And he had an H&M T-shirt made in his honour, which seems terribly ironic.
It does. The commodification of dissent is never far behind the dissent itself. H&M actually withdrew that T-shirt very, very quickly after protestations from, I'm not sure whom, but they said that it was controversial and they were sorry.
It wasn't from the village, it was from the central government.
I think so, because it had the sort of a very controversial message on it, like I think it was food for the people, which is obviously a divisive slogan in contemporary Spain.
With us as well is our much-travelled environment editor, John Vidal, who has just come back from the Nigerian Delta, I believe. Is this a unique story, or is this something that you see in other parts of the world?
It's not unique, and it's certainly not on the Niger Delta, I'll tell you that, because that's in trouble. I mean, it's a brilliant book. I really loved it, because for the first time I've seen a really good study of how something works, why it may not work in future, where it's come from and whatever. And that's this kind of the debate which we've been lacking. These utopian and sometimes socialist utopian visions of communal living, not communist, but communal living, are everywhere now. You've got the Naxalites, you've got the Maoists in Nepal, you've got stuff in India, you've got the Movimiento Sem Terra in Brazil, you've got the old Shining Paths villages in Peru. I mean, they're emerging all the time. Some of them last a long time, some of them fold. A lot of them are based on sort of charismatic people or charismatic ideas, if you like, which have their own time span. But they go back, and there's social ones, there's environmental ones, there's political, the right-wing ones. There's a new utopia being set up in the Caribbean on the lines of Ayn Rand, you know, the sort of right-wing stuff. You've got anarchist villages, you've got hippie villages, you've got the wonderful one in Denmark, Christiania, you've got spiritual ones, Auroville in India. I mean, it's a part of our history. What is so rare is that this is something in Europe. Europe is bereft of this sort of idealistic, utopian vision of living. And it's now very much has been handed over, I would say, to the developing countries.
Dan, your book ends on a slightly muted note that Sanchez Gordillo has sort of disappeared. We know he's around somewhere, but he may be depressed, he may be ill. Indeed, he may be in a television studio somewhere else in the world, embracing his hero status.
That's right. I mean, he did actually go to Chile at some point. I think it was the year before last, in order to try and sell the Marinelada olive oil to their fellow sort of socialist state, successfully, I might add. But yeah, there is a reason why he has to go to South America for that kind of support and solidarity.
But he's part of an international group. I mean, there's people like Jose Bové and others, and they now meet increasingly internationally. And so they're, if you like, the struggle has moved right out into these huge sort of social movements. And so he becomes a sort of very different figure, much more important international figure perhaps than his local figure.
I mean, he is, as you say, Claire, sort of himself muted at the moment.
Depressed, and because it's not going so well now.
I mean, arguably that's the reason. I encountered a huge amount of rumour, hearsay and sort of whisperings. It's a very small village, you can't really hide very easily, and yet he managed it. He had withdrawn from public life when I was finishing the research for my book, just sort of in the spring this year, and he's sort of appeared at one point during one of the carnivals. I was there in a back room, and I kind of was stunned because he hadn't been around for months, but he didn't look that well, and we shook hands and spoke briefly, and he sloped off. He was really just keeping up appearances. It does beg all sorts of questions about sort of the extent to which something like this is guided by messianic charismatic leadership, or the extent to which it is, you know, people power in action.
Also how scalable it is, because you make the point that it's a tiny village of 2,500 people. You couldn't roll it out over the whole of even Andalusia, let alone the whole of Spain or Europe, could you?
But you could village by village. I mean, I think that would be the argument, is a rather than big centralised communist village or Marxist village, you can devolve power down to the village level. So he would argue, I suspect, that this would work on a sort of smaller scale. And, you know, maybe 2,000 people is about the limit. There are very few very large experiments like, you know, than this one. 2,500 seems to be roughly the maximum you can get without it all falling apart. And
that does sort of fit in with the Bakuninist anarchist philosophy of the 19th century. And it's a point I make in the sort of, you know, historical backstory at the beginning of the book, is that when anarchist ideas arrived in Spain in the 19th century, they found a very natural home in the south of Spain, particularly, I mean, in sort of urban Catalonia for different reasons, but in rural Andalusia in the south, you already had what he was describing as his sort of his idealized kind of vision of these autonomous but sort of federated, linked communities, which were probably, as you say, about this size.
But there it's still dependent on the state government to give it, for example, the building materials to build the houses.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, I mean, and this is the criticism that comes from the right, is like, well, you're not actually independent or autonomous at all, are you? Because you require these subsidies, to which they rejoined her, I think, quite fairly. Yes, but the Duquesa de Alba, you know, one of the richest and most titled women, in fact, arguably the most titled woman in the world, who owns all of the land around them, receives hundreds of millions of pounds of EU subsidies for doing absolutely sod all and providing no work whatsoever.
Can we just move on a little bit to the literature of these movements? Sánchez Gordillo wrote a book in 1980 which outlined his philosophy. Is there a big literature of anarchism or communism or whatever it is?
500 years. I mean, you know, Thomas More's Utopia. And then since then, you've had people like Ursula Le Guin writing science fiction about anarchist planets. Louisa May Alcott, she's the woman who wrote Little Women. She was brought up in one of these sort of slightly mad utopian communities, and that's very much led to the book.
I think the reason I, as a journalist and writer of nonfiction, was so attracted to this was because it was real and it was there, you know, there it actually was. You know, they know a bit of their theory in Marinelada. They're interested in sort of some of the various strands of European continental left-wing philosophy. But really, theirs is their own creation, and it's based on their own lived experience. And, you know, it's a point often made by sort of intellectuals in the big cities of the Spanish South, like Seville and Granada, is that they, you know, they admire them for just getting on with it and doing it and creating their utopia, as opposed to sort of pontificating about it.
It seems extraordinary that nobody's written about them before.
I know, I'm very lucky. There hasn't been anything other than one academic tome by a Spanish academic at the University of Seville who did his doctoral thesis on it. But he was really interested mostly in the sort of idea of messianic leadership and in Sánchez Gordillo's kind of role. Yeah, I mean, everyone knows about the village in Spain, but more so in the last 2 years because of the crisis. You know, it really has raised the village up on a parapet, because, you know, everybody's looking around and saying, well, what's the alternative to this crisis? And the answer comes, well, you know, what about Marinaleja? And from there, a million arguments have flourished.
There are a lot of eco-villages setting up in America and Arizona and all over the place, sort of ones which are more sort of environmental than perhaps socialist or whatever. And I think the spiritual communities, I mean, they're really sort of thriving in India. And these, some of these are quite big. I mean, there's 5,000-6,000 people or more. So I just think we're not looking far enough. And, you know, maybe your next book now could be do a worldwide grab of the whole territory, because it is a fascinating, really exciting area.
It is. And it's, I mean, a friend of mine made a point to me recently that, you know, it's kind of, is it not noteworthy that Spain hasn't seen more of these attempts sort of flourishing in the last few years in the way that perhaps in Argentina in 2001 and their financial crisis, you had more and more cooperatives flourishing. And there are other examples in Spain. People, I'm sure, will have heard of Mondragon, which sort of goes back actually quite some time before the crisis. There is a new community called Samonte, which was started by some of these same agricultural labourers in the south, which is only a year and 3 months old at the moment. But there aren't loads of these examples as yet, anyway.
But you could almost argue that the Puritans, when they went over to America, you know, that was an idea, you know, the idea of setting up utopian communities. I mean, you could argue that the kibbutzins in Israel were utopian communities, or some of them anyway.
How long did they last?
Well, it doesn't matter. It's the idea. The idea keeps getting passed on from one group to another group and onwards, and sometimes it's socialist and sometimes... I think it's all a sort of fantastic desire to see what other ways there are to live.
It does matter, though, if you live in this place and... suddenly the state grants dry up, so you can't build any more houses. Or, as is happening, you can't sell your olive oil or whatever it is. Actually, as you said, they did sell their olive oil, but...
they just go back to a capitalist system. I mean, that's a default system, isn't it?
Well, I think that's the question, isn't it? I mean, you know, whether it can be replicated into other communities in the surrounding area. It's another right-wing criticism of Marinaleda that, you know, well, if this is so great, how come the neighbouring villages remain with a capitalist system? And, you know, there are all sorts of possible answers to that, not least their own unique Pueblo identity. I mean, there are right-wing villages sort of, you know, 10 miles down the road from Marinaleda, and that's some, you know, that's the product of sort of centuries of history.
And there's really no resistance inside it?
No, there is opposition within the village, albeit not in any great number. But yeah, I mean, if you look at the recent election results in the village, or indeed going back for the last couple of decades, there'll always be maybe 100 or 200 votes for the Partido Popular, who are the right-wing party, and the PSOE, who are like the centre-left sort of Labour Party equivalent, combined, that is. But I sort of encountered in the nearest large town, Estepa, a couple of people who were said to be exiles from the village, who had sort of been forced out, but I couldn't get them to talk on the record, or indeed to me at all, as a sort of outsider slash journalist. And there were sort of rumours as to whether it was, you know, are these political differences, or is this as simple as, you know, if you live in a very small village and you have an argument with someone that sort of, you know, grows and grows and it just becomes annoying and a problem in a sort of social sense to live there? Or is that a political difference? I mean, there is no gulag in Marinaleda, essentially.
Well, you have two routes, I think, Dan, now. Either 10 years' time you revisit Marinaleda, or you take off on a world pilgrimage, as suggested on this podcast by John Vidal.
Very tempting.
Dan Hancock's and The Village Against the World is published by Verso. As John Vidal said, there are people all over the world trying to find alternative ways of living that protect them economically, satisfy them socially, and make them personally happy, what Dan calls a utopia. Always their success is also determined by a wider historical context, and a prize-winning German novel by Eugen Ruger tells a story about exactly that. Ruger charts the history of a family that once belonged to the East German communist elite, following various members of that family through every kind of economic political system right up to the hypercapitalism of today. Eugen Ruger talked to Richard Lee.
In Times of Fading Light has the grand sweep of a family saga, but without the comfort of a linear narrative. You open in 2001 Berlin, you cut straight to the Pacific coast of Mexico in 1952, then Berlin in 1989, then 1959 again. Why did you decide to tell the novel in pieces?
Actually, I don't know. I always give answers, yeah. And sometimes I say it to compress the story. Sometimes I say to have better associations between the different parts, yeah. Because sometimes you feel that if you have the background before, yeah, then the story when it follows is more effective or more touching. And so there are different answers, but I simply did it.
It came out that way.
It came out that way. I thought a lot about that, about the structure of the book. I thought a whole year, I sat without writing and thought only about the structure.
And the structure you came up with is these episodes, mm-hmm. where you adopt the different perspectives of this family. Yeah. So you have a chapter from the perspective of the grandmother, mm-hmm. and then from Alexander or Sasha, yeah. and then from his father. Yeah. Was it important to you to give each character their own voice?
Yes, the first thing is that my own attitude or my own opinion, changes all the time, you know. I don't know exactly what I think about this whole communism stuff and about capitalism and all those, yeah. Sometimes I think I know, then the next day I think, no, maybe you haven't been right, yeah.
And You're even changing your mind about your own novel here.
Yes. And so I decided to go inside the characters and to tell from their perspectives. That perspectives, I know what it is, and they are constant in some way, maybe they develop in some way, but to keep out, as a writer, to keep out of this whole stuff, you know.
Nevertheless, Sasha's family is very much modelled on your own. When your father was a historian, yes. like Kurtz, who spent time in the Siberian Gulag. You left Berlin a little bit before Sasha, but you left Berlin in a similar kind of way yourself. Yeah. Did you start writing the novel as a way of exploring your family life, or was it just that your family was a good way of exploring the recent history of the GDR?
Maybe both, you know, maybe both, yeah. I wanted to keep something of my experience, of my history, of the history of this land. It's no political statement, yeah. Simply, that was our life, yeah? That was our identity, yeah. That was our history, and your history is your identity, nothing else, yeah. And so after the change, many people, and me too, I must admit, tried to push this identity a little bit away, yeah, because it was a little bit embarrassing, yeah, to belong to those Eastern German people, yeah. And so, but after a while, I understood that there's no sense in it. You have to admit what you are, and that's the book.
Does it feel to you a little bit like you and your family and indeed the whole country were in some sense found themselves on the wrong side of history?
That's a complicated question again. I don't know. I can't decide it. You know, I would say maybe it was the wrong side, but that does not mean that what we have now is the right side. Yeah, it would be too simple, you know. You can't conclude like this. If you say communism has disappeared, had lost, that does not mean that capitalism will survive, yeah? And that does not mean that all the problems are solved here, yeah?
I'm wondering whether the novel has provoked different reactions in East Germany and West Germany.
It has, of course. That maybe the Eastern German people took it, like me myself, yeah? As an admission or what? To their identity and to their history. They were admitting where they came from and what they have been and their lives and their histories. But the Western people, of course, they had, of course, preconceptions. Everybody has preconceptions, of course. We cannot live without preconceptions, yeah. But they are able and they are willing to change them. That was my experience, because people in Western Germany, not only in Western Germany, but in America too, for example. I've been for 2 weeks in America already. And there too, the people want to know how life really was there in this strange state, yeah, which has discovered from the surface of the earth, yeah. They want to know how did it feel to live there, yeah.
And that's something that can only be achieved through fiction.
Yes, I think yes. You can write wonderful historical books, yeah, but to tell how it feels or how it felt to be there and to live there, yeah. You can only do it through fiction, of course.
The title of the book comes from Sasha's grandmother, yeah. Nadezhda Ivanova, who remembers when she was living in Siberia in a small village called Slava. And she remembers the potato harvest, where with smoke rising from the fires, she says, when you began burning the potato stems and leaves, that time inexorably had come, the time of fading light. it's a golden image mm-hmm. that she's evoking of yeah. what was a very difficult time. Mm-hmm. Is that how it feels to many people, that the GDR was beautiful, even if there were things wrong?
I would say yes, and not because of the political system, but simply because that was their youth, yeah, that was their life. They married and they had children and they divorced and everything. What belongs to life, yeah, they had lived through this, yeah. And so, despite the fact that all the thing was going down at the end, yeah, they had such a, how do you say, golden feeling or something like this. Yes, I would say yes.
And you've set out to capture that in your book.
Yes, of course, yeah. I wanted to show, of course, the book is sad in some way, but on the other hand, it's not only sad, yeah. It tells about life that has been, yeah. And the fact that life ends, yeah, is sad, of course, yeah, but that life itself is beautiful in spite of that.
Eugen Ruger, In Times of Fading Light is published by Faber. So, lots to argue about in this week's podcast, so why not take part in the discussion on our podcast page? You can find it at www.theguardian.com/books. We also welcome ideas for other themes or books you'd like to see us discuss, however niche your interest. If you'd like to find out more about Marina Leder, you can read an extract from Dan Hancock's book on www.theguardian.com/worldnews. Our international supplement, Guardian Weekly, meanwhile, is looking this week at the battle for land rights in Colombia. We have another clutch of prize list choices to talk about next week, and then comes the new James Bond novel, when William Boyd visits our Guardian Book Club. For today, though, from me, Claire Armistead, and producer Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag-and-drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.